Welcome back to the very haphazard recording of the Rhetoric Training for America podcast. Persuasion, political persuasion training, rhetoric warriors, the multi-titled, haphazardly recorded podcast for rhetoricians and those who love us.
Okay.
And those who tolerate us. This is, again, it's become, I think Dave Payne and I having discussions on little fragments within the MAGA empire and the Trump empire, which I find fun, and hopefully other people find it useful. I think there's a lot of useful information in here. If you like to dig through rhetorical piles, like there's gems somewhere within this. And today we're going to talk about fascism. I think for me, it's been this idea of watching what I said about the first Trump regime when they storm the Capitol. Was like, it's interesting that they're using amateurs to storm the Capitol. Like, that seems like a flaw in the system. And that's the only thing I didn't see in the first go around, was professionalizing kind of the military forces and the police forces and that kind of stuff. And that ties into, historically, I think, fascism and violence and the uses of, you know, that particular technique, which they've sort of held back on, I think, in fascism 2.0. Like, no bodies on the ground. That's sort of been the dictate, because that doesn't play well at all on TV. And so that leads us into this idea of, historically, what has fascism been? It's a term that's getting bounced around ping pong ball-esque in politics right now. Dave Payne's going to talk to us about this, and we're going to...
Maybe. I think that's an interesting moment that you cite about the amateur rioters of January 6th. Why weren't they using Trump wasn't in charge of the National Guard then. They ran away. When the National Guard told them to go home, they went home, which means we're not in what Echo called like the ur-fascism, where people are willing to die. It didn't seem like they were anxious to do so. And that may be a distinction to be made. But technically, in terms of history, the January 6th riots were more of a fascist embodiment than the current calling out the National Guard, which is more authoritarian or tyrannical or dictatorial. So I think that's part of the problem with the term. Now, last time we talked, it seemed that uncertainty was the term that we're all in this phase of uncertainty. Now, all the pundits are talking fascism. Is Trump a fascist? Or here are the criteria of fascism. So, and fascism is, so now we're certain about something at least, right? I think if we really want to find something useful in the term fascist, I think it gets used for the use of military, for the autocratic state, for the dictatorial state. But technically that happens and is a moment in the evolution of what happens to fascist movements. Fascist movements are technically populist movements. They are,
right.
They are,
they're,
the people.
They're banding together six. That's what fascists mean.
That's
right.
The fascists, that's where the symbol was borrowed by Mussolini. Of the group of sticks banded together around an axe from ancient Rome, right? That we are stronger when banded together. So it really is and the gendering is intentional, a brotherhood movement of strength of the people. So arguably, and I the more I read about this, the more I'm sure it's probably right, is that fascism really only occurs in democracies. It is a symptom of and a corollary to. So we have to generate populist movements. We do that every 4 years, right? And that's why every 4 years you can hear in the rhetoric of a campaign some kind of fascist leanings, right? The brotherhood, the bonding, the people are going to express themselves in taking over the government. And that's kind of a nice little programmatic revolution thing. So I sort of liken it to it is kind of a cancer where the normal growth regulations of cell division go awry somehow.
Yeah.
And it really depends upon and is corollary to or in dialectic with the social democratic ideal. Because the stage one of fascism is really finding what's wrong with us, what the ills are, the complaints. Democracy is somehow failing us here, and that's why then the final stage of it is devolving into dictatorship, because it really cannot be a system of government. It is not a set of doctrines or principles like socialism or democracy.
It's a reactivity movement. It's like
communism, right? So Stalin was a dictator. He was not a fascist. In fact, Stalin said, right, fascism and social democracy are twins. So all the things that we ascribe to, you know, and maybe the problem when we use it that way, or maybe the reason we use it that way so much, is that we really only become aware or worried about fascist movements when they become, right, overtly dictatorial or tyrannical or you know, centrist government, right? They start doing the things that we're seeing happening right now. Okay. So, you know, fascists can't really call out the National Guard. Only dictators can do that.
I think that's really interesting that you pull out like the basis of democracy, especially the democracy of the people versus the oligarchy, you know, or the monarchy, and those other models is a banding together of very small groups of people that can find some type of shared interest in opposing the monarchy and the oligarchy and the dictatorship, right? So it's only
the system's
in that
not working. The system's not working as it's supposed to.
And right, so and it's only the only way to transcend across all those factions and pull them together is to point to the big evil clown on the hill and be like, oh, we got to fight that guy.
Right. And so once again, and we don't even become aware, or we don't remember historically, like Rachel Maddow's been doing a good job of sort of looking at these little fascist moments in the past, or after World War I and during the Depression and even during World War II. And of course, we've had little fascists. I was reminding someone, well, hey, yeah, in the 80s and 90s, remember, we had the militia, we had, you know. It's not just happened in the last 10 years or 12 years or whatever. That's one thing. So really, fascism is not an identifiable thing. It is, you can't just sort of, and that's where academics have gone wrong in trying to categorize it. And so most people looking at it, and I can remember years ago as a rhetorician looking and going, well, this just isn't a useful term because there's nothing discrete about it. But in trying to, as a categorization of belief systems, it's not that. So it really is, and this is sort of, I'm trying to sell my goods. I'm interested in what does rhetoric have to say about it, or what can say about it, and how useful is it to ask whether we're in fascist territory or not.
In some ways, Trump is a dictator, a business guy is a dictator. Like, he runs the company, has a little bit of an oligarchic board behind him. You know, he's got the stakeholders who are the people, you know, and that sort of system coming over into a political system that, like you said, plays with, it always has fascism as a lurking presence in democracy, because democracy is always about binding together groups, you know, so you've got enough power to push something forward. And then Trump is like, oh, I've got enough power to bind together these particular groups, the Christians and the business people and the people who just hate, and I've got a fascist
combination. Well, that's how he got power. We're rhetorically binding these people together in their complaints, right? We are all victims. We are all suffering the ills of a system that is failing us. That is the rhetoric, right? That is the rhetoric. And if you look back to probably a famous essay about the stages of fascism around 1998, Paxton, those were already identified as the common stages, right? This is not unique in any way, shape, or form here. So Trump is not yet a dictator. He's trying. In other words, he's trying to exercise those kinds of powers and doing what they do. Once again, when it leaves the movement of working in a democracy to gain power, right? That's how you acquire power. You get the people together. It wouldn't work, right?
Right.
It wouldn't work in an authoritarian system where people don't get to vote. What? Or you just crush the uprising, right? So anyway, so now it's into the phase of now we have to govern. And the seams in those groups are starting to show up. They really very often don't have common interests. Or if the new regime doesn't serve those groups or serve them equally, then their binding comes unraveled. So, yeah. And well, I think that's also going on.
And I've said this, like the real pain of Trump isn't being felt still, I don't think, by the middle class white population. Like it's all abstract pain. I mean, the idea of picking, I mean, the upside rhetorically of picking a mythic enemy like the illegal immigrant, which is an invisible presence for most people, it's completely overwrought. It's completely over described. And it's not really ever been a problem that I can tell in America for any kind of, you know, illegal.
It really
alien.
Wasn't on anybody's list before they put it there.
So that's the rhetorical efficacy of picking that is that you've picked a non-existent enemy. And so it's hard to fight back. There's nobody there to fight back. Like we see some things about like immigrant populations and we see some imagery of that, you know, kind of fighting back and all that kind of stuff. But none of that is pain being felt by suburban white people, like from Trump policies.
You know, I mean, I talk to people in areas with lots of immigrants or illegal immigrants, if they want to find that terminology. And they claim that, you know, that this pollution is disrupting their societies, disrupting the law and order. It's that there is crime as a result. And of course, you can't sort that rhetoric out from anytime there's competition in the lower classes, right?
Yeah, then I mean, that's the nature of the lower classes.
The other people, right?
That's the that ongoing racism. Cultural nature of that.
Yeah.
That layer of America is always struggling. It's always fighting, you know, for room. It's always doesn't matter whether it's illegal immigration or, you know.
So to some extent, it got talked into existence. Oh, these are bad hombres. Oh, this is crime. And similarly to the Washington D.C. moment here, it's you know the city, the urban landscape
right.
itself.
We're in danger.
Crime.
Emergency powers.
Goes, but hey, we're at a 30-year low. This is getting better. Well, you know, and that is also laced with a racial division. You know, clearly circulating and in amplifying cultural stereotypes to create that right.
Mussolini used the communist, right? Like that was the boogeyman.
Well, certainly, as did Hitler. I mean, yeah. That the Marxists were really the first people put in prison, and that just happened to dovetail with Jewish people. But originally, the Jewish liberals, the Marxists, were the ones, and those were the ones that Hitler had direct kind of ideological conflicts with as a result of his prison experience. So, but yeah, that, they were the liberals were what was targeted, and that is a more parallel moment.
Right. Well, there's right? not
so
enough
the 40-year scapegoating of liberals.
There's not enough communist Marxists in America right now to make that a really terrorist group, you know, for
well, that,
the suburban
but they
saw fear.
It's once again, talking your foe into existence since Newt Gingrich. So for 45 years, they've succeeded among that group of people. And that's how they win elections. However bad Trump might be, electing a Democrat is going to be worse.
Right, the elites, right. all that talk about the intellectual elites looking down on you. But that's not like it's won elections, but it hasn't sort of coalesced military power and police power to round up, you know, these liberals.
Well, that's once again, that's the difference between the rhetorical moment and the governing moment. All right, well, how do you then exercise the power? Right. And what happens at that point when you are the government? Taking over the government and being the government are two different moments, right? So, but just as a kind of an academic footnote, that is all characteristic of fascist rhetoric, mm-hmm. right? The fascist movements have those in common dating back.
Well, and they start to expand their villain list, right? And that's kind of my point. I don't think they've expanded their villain list. Clearly, liberals are a rhetorical villain, but they haven't expanded their boots on the ground villain list. So they're not pulling white people in social media and throwing them into, you know, ICE.
However, gays, transgenders, I mean, if, you know, if you.
But yeah, those are small factions that most people can intellectually, you know, and, you know, empathetically distance themselves from fairly easily, it seems like. But I'm just curious, as to, like, what happens if they do call professors out or judges or things like that? Like, what's that going to look like?
You know, they arrested that student. I think that there's an assault on the university. So,
So it's still elitism, right? So
once again, these are exactly the same institutions. So maybe not the same ethnic groups, but once again, in the administration of power, that ethnic business only gets you into power and is part of the symbolism of banding. Like, how do you band together, right? Find a common enemy. But then in the exercise and administration of power, it is really working to, and Paxton calls it stage four, basically a fascist, that you start to then subvert the institutions that have power. That will be a check on the success of your group, right? So what has happened traditionally in fascist movements is that when they get into power, they do so being sponsored by mostly the conservative elites, okay? So the Republicans thought they control this stuff. They played that game with all kinds of fascist rhetoric in the past, right? This rhetoric, make America great again, is not new, right? It goes back through every basic, right, Republican campaign, going back to Reagan at least. And so that's all standard rhetoric stuff, but also the belief that you can use this and harness this populism and the elites will continue to govern. Okay. So that's the real moment here is now in power, breaking down those elites. Right. And that has been, you know, a 50-year kind of stalking job by the Heritage Foundation and those kinds of people. How do you then start putting people into place and under? So back to the point, the institutions that are being assaulted, ruling elites, intellectual elites, education, the courts, those are all the standard places, the standard institutions to subvert, to then solidify power. So that's also pretty much out of the playbook. Just normally we haven't got this far yet.
That's true. Right. That's what I was saying. Like before, his first regime, he was not able to clean all the people out of the positions of power. There are a lot of still mixed traditional Republicans in positions and institutions of power. Now he could throw, you know, RFK right into the heart of, you know, and you're like, wow, that was fast. I mean, that transition from that, the administrative layer from the first to the second one. Like you can't get rid of Hegseth or however you say his name, even though he's clearly incompetent at what he's doing. And they're going and now they're replacing all the, you know, military leaders within the honeycomb of that stuff. And I'm like, that's when it's going to get really funky.
Right. Well, it is going on. And of course, these people belong to so many different fringe groups that are, you know, feeding at that trough and are willing to supplicate Trump, that one wonders whether they can all get along and function or not, except to maybe kind of the core. And once again, it isn't set a core set of beliefs as much as a core set of practices, which get back to restoring the patriarchy, you know, celebrating the mythic past where things were perfect. You know, getting rid of the fringe elements.
All right. So once again, we come to the Dan position. What am I going to ask you?
Oh, no. Well, I think it's early, but okay.
It is early. I just want to get in there a little bit.
I think there are
earlier.
More differences. There are differences here. Right?
How do we counter this? Because,
well, I think we got to improve our diagnosis. Once again, fascism only gets you so far.
All right.
Are you fighting fascist government? Are you fighting a tyrannical dictatorship, an authoritarian, or just those kinds of urges? Where are we at in this process? And once again, nothing I have to say or should be construed as we shouldn't be worried about There's nothing in these analyses that suggests that there is.
Oh, they're clearly they're on the luge, like they are going down the speedy ice track.
Yeah, because at any rate, you don't know. You know, once again, you don't know whether they're going to succeed or not, and what they're going to mutate into. So even in 1998, when Paxton's looking historically at the fascist groups, he says there's really only one. You know, at stage five, they either go either radicalization or entropy. They either devolve, as in the case of Mussolini, into pure dictatorship. And look what happened to him, right? They hung him in the gas station. So if your dictatorship fails, right, and the fascist urges are still around, and of course in Italy, that can happen. Hitler is really the only successful fascist movement where it could export fascism to other places. And I think that's an interesting historical observation, nobody claims, that's what one thing that makes fascism different from other systems of government. Nobody recommends it for someplace else. It is all local. It is all historical of a time and place, and it never completely repeats itself. It's always differently inflected and realized in each culture. But I think some things have changed here about that. Right now we have maybe a half a dozen successful dictatorships worldwide. It does seem to be exporting. These guys do call each other up, right? Which is new and different. Orban coming to give instructions to the Republicans on how to pull this off. I mean, that's just a bit weird, isn't it? So we do have, and Anne Applebaum, I've been listening to quite a lot, I think is interesting, a historian. She's really not comfortable with fascism. She talks about autocracy a lot, but she really calls these kleptocracies. And so what are we really dealing with here, I guess, is the prelude question to,
it's not your daddy's fascism.
Right. So at what point do people get aware that they're just being swindled for oodles of money? I mean, that seems to be what all of these groups are about right now, that they have, that they're in cahoots with each other. It is, and once again, this one's, instead of necessarily evolving into a dictatorship that has an ideology about how to live. Now, we might say the Christian right, the Heritage Foundation guys, which are basically a third of the coalition. So I want to identify what are the coalitions that support them. And that's the one that probably is worrisome in terms of having the kind of traction, kind of the handmaiden's tale outcome. It could turn into a ruling dictatorship, right? If all these other ones fail, and they probably will. So that's one group. There is the kind of just the middle of the road, disenfranchised Republican MAGA who just wants to give a finger to the democracy, to the system that produced all this weak leadership and left them behind. And they're probably not, that co-optable. And this kind of apocalyptic cult of techno, and it seems to me they have very little to do with the other groups, except maybe rich business people. But they also seem to be most in tune with kind of oligarchy and totalitarian, technological centers that would rule things. Elites, they're elite. So at any rate, the kind of people that J.D. Vance goes and talks to.
Right.
So right. So he's kind of straddling that Christian nationalist, I guess.
I would not go to this party. Like, that is not a good Christian nationalist hanging with the MAGAs, hanging with the apocalyptics. That is not a party I'm attending. I don't think that's going to be any fun at all.
Well, at any rate, but Trump seems mostly just a kleptocrat, right? Kind of wanting an oligarchy to evolve out of this. And that seems to be what has happened in these current fascist takeovers in these other countries, right? They're just basically stacking up trillions of dollars, robbing the public coffers. So at some point, all of these groups that fueled the fascist movement are going to be unhappy about that, I think. But
so, I mean, if you think about it, the evolution of that, you had like the the Marcos, the Imelda Marcos, and that kind of stuff, which were basically dictator kleptocrats in these sort of underdeveloped countries. But how you take over a developed country is the oligarchs have to become kleptocratic, right? Like it has to have a professionalism to it. And that seems to be
Russia. I mean, this difference. Is right.
Well, yeah. And that's, you know, people have made that argument about where I heard this, don't remember where I heard this for the first time, but when the reason why the Soviet Union disbanded and allowed the wall come down wasn't, it was so they could export oligarchy to the rest of the world. Like the oligarchs had been hemmed in, you know, and demonized because of the inheritances of communism. They're like, we need to get rid of this so that we can branch out. So it was basically a franchising moment when the wall came down.
Whether that was the intention or not, that certainly was the effect. But once again, if you go back and look at historically what's happening, I think there's a case to be made that, I don't know, I'm not a Russian expert, but it seemed to me that it's a case of where the current coalition, the system of government that was binding them together and keeping the integrity and unity of these different ethnic groups and regionalities alive, it just simply broke down, right? With our help. So it's just what happens when the normal social structures and institutions dissipate. And in Russia, of course, you know, we went from a feudal society to a modern bureaucratic state in a period of 35 years. So there were never democratic institutions to get in their way. It's not a good example of anything, but except that, yeah, when you lose, when these infections, these oligarchs are opportunistic, if nothing else.
Yeah,
right, there's still a resources there.
They metastasized into the rest of the world.
But what you have is a serfdom population who's not used to governing anything, and so right, that's easy. There's no expectation that, you know. They didn't get there by saying, oh, we're empowered, I guess, to some extent, the communists, but probably that was never.
So I'm curious to what you think then of Newsom. So Newsom seems in the last couple of weeks, you know, with the redistricting thing, you know, Newsom's very traditional in a lot of his rhetoric, very coalition, rainbow coalition in his rhetoric, has been, you know, California forever. But has now stepped up into the role of premier Navalny, kind of, you know, standing in front of the tank. I'm going to fight back. I'm going to bring the forces.
I wonder what
of
you, as a comic, think of. I mean, his satire stuff is lovely, right? Have you seen the?
Yeah, the kind I mean, of the it's parodies just sitting there forever. How often have I said, even on this podcast, hire some good comedians to fight back with Trump, and that's all they're doing. Is not even great comedy, but at least it's in the idiom. You know, it's fine.
Well, the bleeding air with the bottle of ketchup, and you know, I mean, it's
all sitting there to lampoon Trump, you know, in politics, not from the comedy world, but import it actually into the politics and see what happens.
I suppose there's a kind of a dialectical necessity here that the guy's got to become an emperor before you can say, hey, you don't have any clothes on, right? So. These things kind of come together as the apotheosis of Trump becomes more firm that he can be lampooned. But at any rate, that is a component of the Newsom campaign that I thought we might ought to at least acknowledge.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's going to have to. There's a lot of things going on with that. You know, when you look at, again, anti-fascism. So he's kind of building, you know, the white guy monomyth of I'm coming after Trump. And you're starting to see a little bit of people rising up around it and going, oh, there's a guy actually showing power to power, you know, and how much power he has, we will see. But that's the one thing that hasn't worked against Trump. Nobody has been able to really throw power at him, especially since he corrupted the Supreme Court and there's no check at all. Like, how do you use power against a guy who's getting closer and closer to unlimited power? Is it still an option? And that's what I'm interested in, to see if Newsom can step up there and become the white knight, you know, in shining garb.
Article this morning out there in the internet ether. But you've heard this talk being made even from Trump phase one the administration won. You've heard this talk kind of being made. What Democrats need to do is to start their own MAGA-like movement, which means they need leader that embodies the Democratic spirit, right, the brotherhood. You need that kind of passion. Okay, remember when, you know, in the very first, Bernie would have won because he was able to generate the passion, even though he was to the far left, right? We still haven't resolved that tension within the Democrat. So once again, the Democrat is a sort of a democracy, and the Democratic Party is a democracy in failure by itself, where people are saying, gee, we need this kind of internal takeover to empower it, to counter the other MAGA. Maybe rhetorically that's right. I don't, how would I know? But that's certainly going to be, I think, a solution because of the, and this is something else to talk about, the lack of popularity of the Democratic Party right now. And what does that mean? I mean, that's something that you hear repeated day in, day out, that people simply are not, you know, they may not like Trump. They may not like the stuff that he's doing, but they do not see the
Democratic Party. No, they seem pretty popular when they thought they're going to win with Kamala Harris, and I think it's a loser rebound, to tell you the truth. Suddenly they lost and now they're unpopular. Everybody before the election is like, oh, this momentum, and you can feel the democracy again. And, you know, it didn't seem to me that the brand was all that dead. I just think Americans have a real hard time with people who lose.
Well, there is that. I think the face of the Democratic Party that got showed there in terms of the stumbling through the Biden experience and the quasi-nomination of Harris and the failure, I think, yes, absolutely. I think all of that, but laced with, you know, these are the two, Harris and Clinton were the two lowest turnout elections in modern history. And there's, you know, once again, back to the patriarchy and the misogyny, not to mention the racism, which I think is one thing that makes this fascist thing very different. I think that's all in play in terms of numbers of who goes to the polls, who doesn't, and what do they do there. So I think all of that was in play. And so you're right. What does it mean? I think the other thing that, as I parse this out about the low numbers on the Democratic Party, is that parties themselves, the Republican Party is not a party. It is a MAGA movement. It really is the zombie corpse of the old Republican Party reoccupied by MAGA people, right? So parties themselves, with the rise of independence, right? So it's not going to be up. Nobody's going to say, yeah, I like the party. And if it weren't for, you know, the MAGA, Trump, nobody would say they like Republicans either, right?
Right.
So I think we're just simply asking the wrong question in the wrong political environment about, I think we're misreading it. So maybe that does bespeak that we need some other kind of systemic organizing rhetorical movement that is not going to just depend on party loyalty, because I don't think you can. I don't think you can win with just party loyalty. Clearly, we've demonstrated that 3 times now. You've got to have something else, maybe 4 times. So I don't think Hillary didn't win with it, the first time around when she opposed to Barack Obama. Obama had that something extra besides just being a Democrat. So,
yeah, it's called a penis.
Well, I think you know, the Black community certainly got out behind him in a way that they apparently didn't.
Yeah, you got to have a really, really solid block of voters that aren't going to go away, you know. And that, again, I think is the Trump advantage. Like, who else are the crazy racist and things are going to vote for? Nobody. Like, there's nobody else that's, you know, on the national scene that's sort of throwing that stuff around with any type of, other than the governors and the senators, you know, and like the Congress, they get elected with that stuff. But on the national, there was Laura Loomer, you know, one of the crazy influencers around Trump, was even saying a couple weeks ago, hey, when Trump's gone, the movement's gone. Nobody else has this kind of, you know, charisma and ability with the media and things like that. There's nobody in that group that's going to be able to step up and take the mantle. They'll try, but watch J.D. Vance try to, you know, bond with the ragged refuge of America. And yeah, it's not going to be pretty.
Well, once again, that's why of the three coalition, you know, and there may be more to be identified. There are the hardcore Proud Boy kind of militia like fascist movements, right, that say, yeah, we're fascist. And then there's the Christian right, which dovetails with that a little bit, at least rhetorically. You know, the sort of the Heritage Foundation Handmaid's Tale kind of vision of restoring the past, where right, also patriarchal, also misogynistic, also racist, sharing that those values. Then there's the techno fascists, right? Then there's and kind of the middle of the road Republican independent voters that, you know, for whatever set of reasons, can't stomach what Democrats have been serving them. Whether they will in the future or not, it's another question. So yeah, of those three, which one could, you know, multiple choice question, which one could actually emerge a victor here? And I guess it is the well organized machine of the church, the Christian coalition that most concerns me, but.
You know, it's all this sort of gong that just says, come over here and hate somebody. You know, it doesn't matter who, we'll let you hate. You know, you can hate women, you can hate a race, you can hate the elite, you know, it's fine. You know, come on over, and that is not a problem over here. In fact, it's a, you know, it's part of the culture. And I
think it seems to be a requirement now, yeah.
And I see that again. It's sort of an emotional fascism, you know. It's not an intellectual fascism around issues. It's just an emotional binding that, hey, we understand why you might feel really upset about the world and outraged and hate. There's a group over here that you can take those feelings and dump it on, and we will shit on that group as hard as you want us to do, and you'll feel better. And so to me, like the emotional side of that stuff and just watching it being directed around is very interesting.
I think that really is the heart of fascism, is the generation of feeling. And and I'm not the first to say that by any means, that because it isn't an intellectual set of beliefs. It really is this frustration, sense of failure, abandonment, personal alienation. That I don't have a vehicle for my success, so this movement is a vehicle for my success.
Well, and those are all modernity feelings too, right? That's baked into modernity culture, alienation and distancing and lack of ability to get to where it feels like.
Well, it is the politicization of that, tapping that rhetorically for political power, basically.
Yeah,
and despots will ride that power. And if they succeed, then they get power, and then they have to become some other kind of, you know, something else.
Yeah, there's nothing, there's nowhere to go with it. Once you ride that dark surfboard, you know, to the top of the wave, you're just sitting there going, well, now how do I?
It's just at this moment, I think the red flag has to go up. Don't feel safe as a result of thinking, you know, this can't outlast Trump. Because what cures us of Trump may be worse, right?
No, that's why I said, like, it was somebody in his camp that said that. I don't think anybody's sitting back going, well, this is all. It is in some ways, I think, accelerated by Trump. Trump's a singular talent that didn't exist anywhere else because he had deep media training. He was already culturally known. He has, you know, training in being a villain.
He could have best embodied the fascist need for that leader that can embody the spirit of the brotherhood here. And that seemed to most of us go, what, really? This kind, but if you start, you know, he is an outlaw. He is just, you know, he is more like the core of that movement. He seems unlikely as a Christian leader. He seems unlikely. All of that is still making heads spin.
Yeah, but I mean, just
but he is the outsider. He is the outsider that can do battle with the rich people,
right? And he's a, you know, singular leader, so it still plays into the Jesus myth and the God myth and all that stuff. So still a guy at the core of it. They've already been trained to believe in fantasticalism and, you know, faith and non-logic, so it's fine. They're like, oh yeah, well, it doesn't quite cohere that he acts like this, but he's also this. but they're fine with pseudo logic. So
what's
they don't
gonna, it only it, there's only maybe a third of the people that really can bond to that symbolism. The rest are part of the coalition that can ride that power, right? Until he gets rid of them or something. So something else. Or they're interested.
Really needs
along
more
the term.
Sacrificial lambs. You know, doesn't.
So when they quit being part of the kleptocracy, when they quit getting empowered as a result, then.
When you saw a little bit of that,
I don't
with
know.
With the Elon Musk, you know, fracture, right? You saw a little bit of an oligarch getting a little too much power, and Trump going, "Oh no! I can't have like a co-person in the media. Like, you have to keep him down here. I'm the guy who gets all the media attention." And that's the only reason why Trump got upset with him. It wasn't that he was taking too much money or anything else. He was getting too much
attention.
But
Musk got upset with Trump about, "Yo, wait a minute. My job here was to reduce the federal deficit. You were going to really reduce the spending, and you doubled it."
Yeah,
that was the issue.
Right, but that's Trump's whole thing.
He started criticizing Trump.
He's just an attention person, and the actual policies and even the money and stuff, like, he doesn't understand any of that stuff. So he's like, "Look, I'm just getting attention here, and you're in my attention space. I don't care what you don't like. You know, you've got to go." And so, I mean, I think there was a moment there where people were like, "Oh, is there going to be like a little civil war within the, like, you're talking about the coalitions?" I call it the MAGA pie. Like, there's a pie of all these little slices, you know, and there's the big ones, and then there's all these little things over here. And the first thing I do when I break this apart for people is like, "Well, which slice of the pie are you talking to?" If you're trying to counter and bring some of those people back, like, it's very different going after Christian nationalists and trying to bring them back to democracy than it is technocrats and bring them back. So you have to slice the pie correctly. But you saw just a little bit of civil war within the MAGA, you know, stuff within the right with Musk versus Trump. And it didn't last long, same way, like, you know, Putin, you know, put a bomb on his general's plane as he's flying around. Like, any kind of resistance gets taken out pretty quickly. Trump isn't at the point yet where he has to kill anybody.
Constructive authoritarian dictator, yes.
Right. Well, Trump doesn't have to kill anybody yet. He can just fire them. Like, he hasn't had to move to murder. You know, Putin,
I like the idea of firing as a symbolic form of assassination.
It's totally what it is. It's a complete assassination. And that's what I said in Authoritarian 2.0. They don't have to kill people. They just.
Well, that's right out of The Apprentice. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Take them out of the system. And that's why all the senators and all the, you know, everybody in Congress knows, like, if they say anything, they'll just be removed. So, you know, it's a form of murder.
Well, back to the central question, though, of what survives here. I do think that the fascist origins of MAGAism and Trumpism probably will dissipate. I don't think they will mutate into right.
We're not going full Orban. We're not going full kleptocracy, authoritarian.
Right, because too much of the coalition is just about greed. When that fails, you know, now what will it be replaced with, and you know, what will we return to anything like the democratic structure that we had is another question altogether. And it depends on a couple of things. One is, how big are our problems? How, you know, we're economic and climate change, and we have a lot of unsolved problems.
If you have a depression, suddenly you're much more, you know, into socialism.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I wonder, studying, going back and reading about the history of fascism and stuff, of how many people in America saw Roosevelt being elected 4 terms and merging with the government, using the government to stimulate business. How many of them saw that as a brand of, right? He was hated by a good chunk of the, you know, he was the problem to many people. So, you know, and then that, of course, got all interfered with by total war, which is yet an option on the table.
It's China's burbling around Taiwan and stuff. Like, I would not be at all surprised for that to break out before the end of the Trump regime.
So one thing is, are we successful enough? Is there a line here that will defend the democratic state in terms of will we have a decent election? So we're nibbling away at that. If we have a decent election, things can go on more or less as before with stalemate and we're getting enough. You know, Ann Applebaum made the point, but when they got to that moment in the conversation of, well, how do we fix this? This was with Scott Galloway. I was noticing his pod, but and she's really a very important person. She said, well, the easiest way to fix this would be what you need. You need three senators and seven congressmen to simply say we've had enough. And within the confines of the current, right, Congress can stop him from doing the things. Congress can stop him from using the National Guard. Congress could stop him from
maybe
gerrymandering. Yeah, maybe. Well, once again, that would be the easiest fix if we could see that happen. It would be nice to test that. Then the second way would be in the next election, okay, the people be sufficiently fed up to hand the government back to the Democrats or, you know, something like that to get the Republicans who are loyalists currently out of control, if we can use still right exercise of democratic power. So I think that's what's on the table at the moment. It's
getting to that. You know, Trump met with Putin this week and immediately went after the elections, right? Next day, like mail-in voting, electronic, you know, it's all corrupt. Like instantly was after, right at the election.
You think Putin whispered this into his ear? That
you know, I think Putin has been his mentor with a lot of this stuff
whispering
all along. You know, it's like, hey, I think
we
can take
America.
Sometime
back where Putin said, "Well, just throw him in jail for 10 years. That'll straighten him out." Well, and Trump's sitting there, well, hey, can we do that? You know.
Again, they're nibbling around all that stuff, and America doesn't have a lot of experience with it. And one of the things I was saying is that America saw fascism across the waters, right? We saw it over there. We saw Hitler over there. We saw that stuff over there. It's never been circulating around here, you know, that type of intensity.
Or when it's your own, you don't see it that way. When you see when it's your own, you see it as a populist movement, or you know.
Yeah, it's less.
Once again, we don't recognize it as fascist until it gets to that Mussolini Hitler kind of stage, right?
Bodies on the ground. That's what I'm saying. Like it's not until you have a lot of video of people being carried out of Kent State and things like that, where you're more like, oh man, this is these guys are seriously dangerous. Right now, they're just firing people. You know, like the guy, you know, Vindman, who, you know, originally reported on Trump,
right,
you know, and Ukraine, and he just fired him. And so gone. It's like, well, that's a symbolic killing. And he's taken out of the system of power. Now he's reentered by becoming a congressman, you know.
Well, you know, some U.S. citizens that get sent off to one of these concentration camps. I mean, and
what color are those citizens? Again, I think
that's
white
problematic.
People can't
that's
think outside the abstraction of American versus white American. I'm not sure people react well to, oh, you know, smaller population American is being, you know, systematically violently treated versus people down the street, you know, the Millers. We don't seem to be very good at making that, you know, move.
Well, there's no doubt that that's under that cloak is why it's get passing under the radar as much as it is. That's for sure. And once again, four dead in Ohio. I mean, you know, they start killing some kids or right.
It's only four. Boy,
well,
those
were simpler times. Those were simpler times.
There's a lot of work those four did rhetorically.
Yeah, if you're exporting, you know, or arresting Palestinian foreign students, that's a whole different.
Right, but they didn't have to even say four white kids dead in Ohio, but that was, you know, essentially the power of that symbology. And the question is like, what when you're going to fight back against a modern fascism? Some of the tools that we've had in the past, like showing bodies on the ground and the horror of this stuff, don't seem to be working. Like they're not giving that kind of fodder to, you know, fight them back with right now. They understand the difference. They're being a lot more sophisticated in what they're doing to America.
back to what's different about now than 25 years ago or 50 years ago or, you know, 75 years ago. One is our social organization through technology, through technical media, right? Social media. That's different. We are all more, and you and I have, you know, crossed that bridge a couple of times in our conversations. We get to the, well, yeah, the stream of disinformation, the stream of confusion, the significant portion of the population who doesn't even know what's real, and the degree of the population that is so frustrated by that they don't even try to figure out what's real. So even if you're a member of one of these groups that might be disenfranchised, keeping track of the politics, being active in politics, requires that much effort. Because and confusion is serving them, creating that kind of confusion. Furthermore, just sort of the atomization of how do you band the sticks together when you can't get the sticks in the same place?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and somebody's coming along with, you know, a machete constantly cutting your sticks apart again. You know, a rhetorical machete to be like, no, you guys really don't like each other. You really aren't that much bonded together.
We can't break, as long as we can break the sticks individually, we can rule. And that's kind of what's going on.
Breaking the sticks is breaking the binding, right? So it's like, hey, these people are not Americans. They're illegal immigrants. And people are like, well, isn't everybody an American illegal immigrant? Like, did we come here legally from England?
This fascism has cropped up in the weaknesses of the democratic system, and its weaknesses are, you know, both the hugeness of the problems that we face, our inability to agree, our urban rural, and you know, divides, our technological religious divides. All of those divisions are operating against recreating unity. And this comes through, says, well, we can generate it. We can generate it. It's generating the symbolism of that. And if you do it for 37%, apparently that's enough, as long as somebody else out there can't get 40 together. So that is one of the components that, you know, is threatening to us, I think, in terms of the recovery phase. Secondly, just the sheer abject racism that undergirds so much of the division that is being exploited here, between the political parties, between, invading LA with people waving Mexican flags, invading Washington, D.C., and all the cultural stereotypes that attend to it.
We're going into minority population areas.
Yeah, and I'm not the first person to observe this by any means, that those, you know, the belief that this is such a crime infestation that we've got to take it over by martial law. You know, that's not Boston. It's not Minneapolis. Is it a good practice for that? We'll see. So once again, the sheer racism of this moment, and the alignment of people politically can't be underestimated as a significant difference with modern America, current America, than other previous examples. So history doesn't save us from this moment in the least.
It doesn't. And I make this argument a lot that they've experimented around and found new anti-democratic rhetorics. Like, we need to experiment around, and this is one of the reasons at least I like what Newsom is doing, even with the comedy, experiment around and find new, powerful democratic rhetorics. Because, like, the civil rights rhetoric, which has driven the Democratic Party for so long, seems to have tapped out. Like, it got shoved farther and farther down into farther and smaller splinter groups. It's not women's rights and black rights. You know, it's now like all these splinter groups, the fascism, the binder has like gotten stretched so much that the civil rights rhetoric, I'm not sure, is strong enough to win against what's popped up on the other side of the, you know, kind of hate infested rhetoric of the GOP.
Right. Well, sort of the reaction to the reverse racism kind of binder, I guess, is about as
well. They've got their own race rhetoric.
Two things: the patriarchy / misogyny, restore male rule, and that's bigger than I think it's getting notice.
Yeah, well, you've seen it all in like the bro culture.
That is the one thing that every fascist movement has held in common, if there's one common theme. So let's go back to the time when men ruled this.
Right, so it's a gender rhetoric.
As much as anything.
Yeah.
But also order, right? Who's in charge and control and all of that. So whether that's a subdivision of gender or gender is a subdivision, who knows? But that and then the racial part. And to embrace race, to embrace the social democratic ideal and the inclusive one, that's feminine in a sense compared to.
Sure.
And that's people really want strength, and they because they're fearful, they think strength is the only, and that is the only rhetoric of strength that we have right now, right? No, we
and Gavin Newsom.
How many yeah. other cultures have had female presidents and prime ministers and leaders? Because you could be a strong female in those cultures. We simply do not have. I mean, you know, look at the females that we're treated with. You've got to have, you know, the sort of Barbie hairdo, I guess, to get a position. And
over
the other,
there, you're starting to see
40
like,
or so.
Like I'm, you know, sitting miles away from Texas legislature right now, where the Democratic rep, a black woman, refused to go home because they were making her sign a permission slip and have a police escort. And so she's been down in the courthouse, like in the, in, you know, Texas Congress, just sitting there, you know, and won't leave. And they've got her locked in. But you're starting to see like where the parts of the American culture where there are strong females, like black culture, you know, they are allowed to at least inhabit that. And then Trump comes in to attack them, you know, and sort of the way he always does.
Well, then you flip the race switch, and then you flip the liberal switch,
right.
And then, you know.
Yeah.
You got it all lined up. I don't know whether we can overcome those things in any short order. It's fast enough to, you know, save the climate.
There's an interesting power about it, though, like Jasmine Crockett and the kind of highly verbal sort of rhetorical heroes, you know, like that, who stand up and have interesting attacks and heckles and, you know, takedowns of Trump. And maybe it's just me because I like verbal people so much, but I instantly was like, yeah, I'd vote for her. You know,
sure.
I was never like that about Hillary. Hillary was never deft, you know, verbally deft like that. She was publicly clumsy. I think she was plenty smart. I voted for Hillary. Like, I'm like, yeah, put a smart person in there and I'm fine. But like, it's a superpower, that sort of hyperverbal, you know, female. You know, the Ann Richards, you know, sort of.
Yeah, think about her a lot. Think
you know,
about her a lot.
Glided in there and it's like, they're like, this chick is sassy, you know, and people in Texas were like, I'll vote for that. I'll vote for sassy. So I don't know. That's an interesting rhetorical hero. Newsom isn't, he's a little clumsy. Like, there's something about his speech patterns where he's really good. And then when he's trying to like be performative or something, he kind of like loses the lingo. So I'm a little worried about him having that type of verbal facility. But I've seen him do really well, too. Like when I was in California.
I think he's very smart, and I think he is very deaf verbally. But he's being cool at the same time.
Well, and he's trying to be dumb. That's part of the problem. Like for people that are smart, like trying to dumb down while you're talking is hard. You know, and he's completely smart enough to do it. I've heard him very much go off on things intellectually. I'm like, oh, he understands what's happening here.
Yeah.
But Trump had no problem at all going dumb. Like, he was very good at moving down that
well,
you know.
Super. No, that was no effort. That was a short putt. Absolutely.
Well, he knew from his promoter days in tech and, you know, in entertainment that you just got to keep it simple. Simple villains.
Well,
and just
repeat what other people, you know, what?
Yeah, he's been given script, you know, that's simple, but.
Well, I mean, you know, these are not, there's just so little that's original in all of these things. It's just sort of a default bank of stuff that, you know, the conspiracy stuff and the kind of easy analysis and who's to blame.
You're even seeing that with the Democrats stretching to try to describe Trump. The idea that he wants to be a king or, you know, a dictator or authoritarian. That terminology doesn't really exist like that in America anymore. We've never had a dictator. We've never had a king. So, you know, it's, again, it sounds European. It sounds like the past. It's maybe not and strong fascism, enough.
He gets defended from fascism with the same, same kind of.
To me, I've described him before, like he's just a horrible boss. Like almost everybody's had a boss like boss. Trump, you know, who just makes everybody's life hell, makes horrible decisions. And if he would just get out of the way, you could run the company.
Well, there is that. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, it's just people's ability to live in denial and to select facts, I guess. I don't know. That's just a measure of their desperation, I suppose, is how you can bend him as a shapeshifter into that kind of rhetorical hero. I mean, yeah, bad boss, bad leader, bad CEO, bad, you know, bad businessman.
Just bad at this.
The evidence is all there, but that doesn't seem to matter. Because he's channeling the inner truth. That's right. What they believe to be common sense and obvious, and that is this sort of traditionalist, grassroots, salt of the earth. And it doesn't matter that he's never been those things. It doesn't matter at all.
There's no connection to the evidence down here. It's all story.
And part of that is a symptom of television having occurred on a TV screen for most, politics being a political show. That's where it all takes place. We know these are actors playing these parts. We don't care.
I don't know if you've seen Mark Maron's new special. I'm a half fan of Maron. I very much like the work that
he
does.
I like it a lot.
That his comedy doesn't always grab him, but he always has some lines in there and some insights. And one of them is about the, you know, when he spends some time going after his own liberal people and he says, you know, we got to deal with our buzzkill problem. You know, like liberals just kill the buzz in the room, the vibe. It's, you know, it's like somebody just told a joke and you're like, well, what about the Guatemalan? You know, and I'm like, God, can't we just do a joke? You know, and part of that too, it's like all that cultural fray that they've gotten to see. I still see that very commonly cited as why they like Trump, that he just doesn't force them into this more complicated social, you know, ecology. It's like keep the social ecology clean and simple, and I'm much happier.
Dare to be somewhat offensive, and not be immune to being corrected, right? So. Political correctness involves people getting corrected a lot.
Right.
And that is kind of that buzzkill moment, right? I've had a few experiences like that recently.
Well, tell me your final thoughts on fascism here. Like, what do we do? What's the trajectory here?
Well, our political institutions require populism. Our democratic, we certainly need to work on updating our consciousness about the modern communication media component of this, people's sophistication and how that limits and interfaces with that, I suppose. Calling on mass education is nice, but it's a long project that we seem I keep saying I fought ignorance my whole life and I've lost. So.
Badly, yes.
So I don't know.
I don't know. You de-ignoranted me. Like I remember, lots of moments when you said something like, I've never thought about that before.
Anyway, certainly in the short run, you've got to build a coalition and once again take charge of the political processes. I think once again that can only grow and prosper in complete dissipation of the strength. I think Americans believe themselves to be hard to dominate, hard to, and that's part of what the MAGA expression is. Oh, this new kind of Europeanized, intellectualized. I think there is still huge distrust to elites. David Brooks, although I'm not a big fan, has lately, he's kind of a conservative but intelligent New York Times contributor, talking about the meritocracy. And of course, that part of that has to do with educational systems, which education is, I think very much one of the major institutions on the line right now. And moving, all the way up K-12, the kind of stuff that's being annexed by ideology. But his recent thing on meritocracy and sort of the disaffection of the American public with the meritocracy. I see that as relevant because I think that's a big part of in my I'm blanking on his last name right now. The What's the Matter with Kansas guy? He's great, but Thomas, his critique of what's happened with liberalism and the Democratic Party that has been governed by these educated elites. And so this idea that the meritocracy is in a way part of what's being reacted against by the middle class, by the MAGAs, by N plus, so that, and that gets back, I think that one of the faces of that is the liberal smugness. We just want to be right. I think somehow that's got to be, in other words, for complete political enfranchisement and restoration of the progressives.
I think it's sitting there as a pinata for the right to hit. But as somebody who grew up in Kentucky and was surrounded by seething ignorance and didn't like it and sort of fought my way through it and out of it as best I could, it doesn't seem smug to me. Like I have a lot of, I know a lot of people who are still swimming around in the ignorant waters who are like, how dare you? You know, I'm like, well, how dare you stay there? Like, doesn't it bother you to be ignorant?
Whether it's a real problem or a rhetor or a PR problem, I don't know. But I, and I'm guilty too. I'm guilty too. Absolutely, because we are part of, we are, and we have succeeded through those elites. The meritocracy system was the only thing that allowed me, as a lower middle class kid, to be where I, to have my career and do what I do.
It's nuts. So, I'm one generation off tobacco fields. What, in Kentucky tobacco fields? Literally, my dad has pictures of him. I have pictures of my dad when he was a kid.
Well, you might look at Brooks's essay because he's saying that system has itself sort of been corrupted. It worked really well for us, but maybe not working so well right now. It's at least a good question to raise.
Yeah, it is. I just always look at it and think. I do think
if you want to ask why the sociology of the original MAGA movement felt the way it did about experts, about educated elites, about Democrats, I think there's a lot of answers in there as to the feeling that generated that. Now, whether it's legitimate or not, but once again, just sort of saying, oh, you're stupid and you're wrong, hasn't been a winning strategy.
Well, right. And I this was funny. My son Zeke told me, he goes, my buddy Jake, who's his workout buddy, said he listened to your podcast, like just out of the blue. And I'm like, really? What did he say? He goes, your dad likes to use a lot of big words.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And I'm like, you mean accurate words? You mean like words that actually accurately describe what's going on in the situation? Like, but the idea that the vocabulary is something that they can be jarred by, like, it's, again,
he was a man of the people. Yeah.
Right. These are not like, I'm as least academic probably as they come, but like the idea that the things that they can easily react to, like the surface things, they look different. They sound different. They talk different. And that's enough to, again, coalesce, create a coalition of hate or resistance to that thing. When I see it as like, when I hear people talking above me or know more than I do, I'm attracted to that. I'm like, great, this is an opportunity to learn something. But we got to get back to like, and I do a lot of that.
You also have a PhD and learn to put pride and identity in that.
I'm not against that at all, but I'm solidly understanding of where I come from. And I still talk to that population all the time. That's why I don't mind going on right-wing podcasts. And I talked to a woman who's gotten sucked up into the Libertarian Party, here in Austin. And she was in the paleo movement. So she's always been kind of moved into alternative movements. Like that's been her thing. But now she's spouting off a ton of, right-wing propaganda. And I'm like, I need to slow you down. I need to sort of, and I'm going to maybe do a class for her, her organization about what happens when you absorb unethical persuasion. It doesn't matter where it comes from, what it does to you. And then you end up becoming a spokesperson for that. But I don't feel antagonistic or, you know, hateful towards those groups. I feel like it's just somebody's not been defended. They didn't learn how to defend their brain. They didn't learn what these techniques do. And I was lucky enough that I did. And so I still have that sort of maybe egalitarian feeling of giving back to the working class community and that kind of stuff where,
absolutely,
you know,
absolutely.
So that makes, if that makes us elitist, well, I don't know what to do. Like,
take back unions. Absolutely. Take back. Right. Once again, where, let's figure out where the democratic unity really did exist and how do you restore it? Right. How do you fix it rhetorically and celebrate it rhetorically would be at least one of the pages in the book.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even when you look at how you re-deify democracy, you know, it was deified forever within America. And now, like, somehow it's been, I guess we've ignored it for so long. People don't really, they just see it as civics class or something. You know, I'm like, no, we've got to deify democracy. Like, you can't let the kleptocrats take that much of it and expect it to still function. Like, and when it goes away, man, like, you know, Athens lost democracy in what, 322 BC, and then it didn't really appear again in the world until 1776. That's 2,000 years of dead democracy, you know. So don't you know?
Sure. Well, you know, we look at where democracies seem to be succeeding, and they're great examples. But once again, the sort of the American exceptionalism and anti, you know, European, you know, we're the real thing. Always gets in the way of asking, you know, if this idea that we need to compete with places like China, or we need, you know, wait a minute, really? That you mean we need a huge population of people that don't earn, you know, enough money, so we got to compete with them in manufacturing? Is that, you know,
it's a weird world trying to keep a democracy going amongst all this, you know, these other systems. Same way it was always weird for a communism to try to survive amongst capitalisms, right? So it's...
And once again, and that fundamentally is contradictory to the idea of getting rid of all the immigrants, who are the ones here able, willing to work for the, you know, to be the underclass and do the working that help you to do that. And a lot of Republicans really seem to understand that.
Well, and that may be one of the things, you know, one of the avenues into a really nice criticism of what's happening that people would understand, that you're destroying capitalism. It's not democracy. Like, you're destroying capitalism, you know? And when they start to feel that, maybe that'll become a little more real, you know, and concrete, which is apparently the only thing that really moves Americans is, you know, good concrete suffering.
Greed is good. It will save us from, right? Hate.
Well, fun. Yeah, good. I'm glad we did fascism. Maybe next time we do militarism.
Well, I hope they all go home and we don't have anything to talk about.
That'd be great. Maybe we'll have just a podcast like, isn't this great, man? All this democracy.
Once you start digging in historically into that stuff, I mean, fascism is kind of down my wheelhouse of rhetoric, but militarism and military history and military takeovers, that's scary stuff, and I don't know that much about it. But
that gets very scary. Like, I watched The Rise of Rome and The Fall of Rome on Great Courses, which is on Amazon, which you can get for like $6 a month, just because I knew, you know, in general, a bunch of stuff about Rome and Greece history with this stuff. But it was interesting to really lock it down, and you see, you know, 200 years of the military killing every emperor that got into power, you know, often within 6 months, you know, in Rome, and just the deterioration.
Well, that's where the Brotherhood was bound,
you know, and they became the system. Well, can you survive the military once you get into power?
Well, one of the more hopeful things I heard reported was that of the 72 or something like that, I'm sure I'll get all these numbers exactly right, but the spirit is right of the report anyway. Who had served, National Guardsmen who had come up for reenlistment during the occupation, I think, of L.A., only like 20 had reenlisted, which is considerably, normally the reenlistment rate is like 60-some percent. And they interviewed these guys and they said, no, this is not what we're supposed to be doing here at all. So, where the military, where the boots on the ground really want to be, could be a determining factor.
Yeah, it's all brand new. That's what I was saying. Maybe next time we'll do a little militarism, the rhetoric of militarism and the realities of what that means. Again, America's never really done this to itself. So we'll see what happens.
That is true.
Well, thanks. Enjoy it from Nashville. When do you go to Italy? Or not Italy, Portugal?
Going to Portugal right. In October.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe we'll try to get back in here before you hit the European shores. Once again, thanks. Appreciate it.
Good to see you. Nice to chat, as always.
Always fun. There you go. Go out in there. Don't be fascist, y'all. Break the fascist chain. All right. See you.